This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Number 60. I'm Veronica.
And I'm Tom.
Huh. I forgot to use my last name. I'm
so
Veronica.
So I did. Dalmont. So I got rid of the merit too. Whatever you do, I do.
Welcome to The Sword and Laser. This is the show where we read science fiction or fantasy novels, discuss them on our forums, and talk about them here on the show.
And sometimes we watch TV shows.
We watch a lot of TV shows.
Game of Thrones, I think, will be on our minds quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. That was some episode, huh? No spoilers here tonight, but when they got to the scene by the river, I was like, oh, no, not this scene already.
It's actually funny because I turned to Eileen and I'm like, oh, this is happening already? And she's like, I think I have to leave. She hasn't read the book, but she could just tell by looking at my face that she was not going to like what was going to happen.
Really? She sounds worse than I am.
Yeah. Well, it had to do with the direwolf.
Eventually.
With Lady.
You're spoiling things now.
I'm not spoiling anything. All I'm saying is it was a scene that involved the direwolf.
There was a lot of direwolf action in last night's episode.
There was. They're all over. The thing was lousy with direwolves.
But I'm worried about where's John's dog?
My friend Nicole, I know they haven't shown John's dog.
Really?
My friend Nicole is like does not feel like they're doing the bonding of the direwolves very well.
It's not, I don't feel like it's coming across strongly enough that they're basically like, you know, fully bonded with these animals.
And I don't think they've done Kat as strong as she should be.
I think she was pretty strong last night.
I don't know. I imagined it stronger for some reason, you know, but yeah. Okay.
Well, we are getting off topic because not everyone is an HBO user.
Yes.
So I really feel like a user now at this point. They've got me locked in.
Give me my stuff, man.
I need my stuff. I just need my fix.
A third episode of Game of Thrones, man. yeah, so let's move on to something that people can read for free. Hugo Award nominees.
Yes, they're available right now. There's a list of them on the Mary Sue. And if they have a link next to their name, that means you can click through to the website and download the book in ebook version for free.
Yeah, so a lot of the short stories, novellas and novelettes are available online from their various publications like Subterranean Magazine, Asimov's, Clark's World, such.
Even Tor.com, yeah.
Yeah, so you can click through from the list. I've actually noticed SF Signal did the exact same thing where they listed all of the nominees and allow you to click through to anything that's available for free online. Also, Best Dramatic Presentation. And there are three Doctor Who episodes up.
Oh, and also one thing that is awesome. I won't use the F word on this show because I think maybe we're a family podcast. The Ray Bradbury song written by Rachel Bloom.
The CeeLo, can we call it CeeLoing?
The CeeLoing, CeeLo Me, Ray Bradbury.
CeeLo Me, Ray Bradbury. Written
That's
by
a good way to do it.
Rachel Bloom.
Which is a great video that came out last year, and it was phenomenal, very funny, and well-deserved nomination.
Best novels nominees are Blackout All Clear by Connie Willis, Cryoburn by Lois McMaster Buchholz, The Dervish House by Ian MacDonald, Feed by Mira Grant, and The 100,000 Kingdoms by N.K. Jemisin, none of which I have read.
And none of which are free.
No.
And The 100,000 Kingdoms, that was recommended to us by Patrick Rothfuss? Or was that recommended to us by Joe Abercrombie? One of them recommended that book to us, and I can't remember which one.
You've just ruined our relationships with both of them now.
We had lovely, long discussions with both of them.
They're like, oh, you can't keep us straight, huh?
One week after another, and
one of them low fantasy writers with the long books, I don't know.
The postmodern fantasy writers, yeah. Yeah, so it's understandable, right?
Yeah, but no, you're right. The 100,000 Kingdoms was recommended. So I don't know.
Whatever. You can't remember either.
We'll be needing a new book after Blindside is done. So we'll keep that in mind.
Ooh, and Fables, Witches by Bill Willingham was also nominated for Best Graphic Story. And I like Fables a lot.
And my favorite, The Unwritten, which volume 2, The Inside Man, was nominated for Best Graphic Story as well. I really love that story. So, I mean, obviously, Hugo Awards, always a good cheat sheet if you want to find good material.
Absolutely. Also, the BSFA Awards have also been announced. The nominees. I'm pulling up the website.
And that she's opening the envelope. And the nominees are...
The winners are, actually.
Oh, yeah, these are the winners. That's right.
Novel, The Dervish House by Ian MacDonald. Short fiction, The Shipmaker, Aliette de Baudard. That's French. Art, the cover of Zoo City by Joey Hi-Fi from Angry Robot. And nonfiction, Blogging the Hugos, Decline by Paul Kincaid.
Do you think that was the BSFA kind of sticking it to the Hugos?
Wait a second. Huh. Good segue, Tom.
Anyway, these are the British Science Fiction Awards. So good stuff coming out of there. Dervish House, Ian MacDonald, another recommendation. It's going on my list.
There are so many books I need to read. Speaking of Game of Thrones, I found this great article over on the Wart Zone, and it's about the title sequence that we've been seeing for the past two episodes, which, you may have noticed, has been slightly changing week to week. And they're actually going to be changing the title sequence depending on what areas are being focused on for that episode, which I think is really, really cool.
Yeah, and I've mentioned this before, but I've been talking about Game of Thrones on so many different shows. I probably didn't mention it on Sword and Laser.
What we talked about was that you get to see all the areas on the map, which we thought was cool that it jumped around from place to place. But I'm not sure if on this show we mentioned that they change or that they will.
Yeah, so you're going to get a tip off of what regions will be highlighted on that episode because you will see them. For instance, on the second episode, you don't see Pentos on the map because they're not in Pentos. They're in the Dothraki Sea.
Yes. And
they're not in Dothraki Sea. They're in the Dothraki settlement. I can't remember what it's called.
Dothrak, I think.
Yeah, there you go.
Is that it? Something like that. So this was done by Agnes Wall and his company Elastic. And they also created the Rome title sequence, which won him a BAFTA, and also Carnival, which won him an Emmy. And so he was also an editor on The Social Network. He's just highly qualified, as Adam said on the Wart Zone, to do this job.
And Adam actually pointed out that good title sequences is a disappearing art on commercial television. He says on American television, but it's commercial television generally, because there are so many more minutes of commercials being packed in that a lot of shows just give up that time that they would take for a title sequence and put it back into the story because they only have so much time. So Lost is a good example of that, where you just get the title and a chord of music and they go right into the show.
Oh, Adam says it's actually Vaestothrak, not Val d'Othrak.
Ah, very
good. Did you just hear those I am noises? Sorry, audience. I have I am noises happening.
I did not hear them.
All right, they get mad at me when it's Skype sounds, but this time it was Adium, so I apologize if you heard that. Maybe not, because I wasn't hijacking Adium, just Skype. So we'll see.
Well, anyway, now you've called attention to it.
I know. I'll probably edit this out. Maybe not. They're going to show later, probably, you know, Storm's End, River Run. I think we'll probably see River Run in the next episode.
Yeah, that's true. I wonder if we'll get the Crossroads.
Oh, definitely, I bet.
If it'll get its own little tiny place, the Inn at the Crossroads. Place.
And hopefully the Alliance won't totally troll us there. See what I did there?
In the Barrens. Wait a minute. All of a sudden it's the instance. let's move on to the 10 most badass dragons ever by Annalee Newitz over at IO9. I guess dragons on the mind these days with Game of Thrones. So you're a big dragon fan. She's got 10 pretty hot dragons here.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I saw this post and I was highly interested immediately in the
content. Gee, I wonder if number one caught your eye.
Well, let's see. All right. So should we go through the whole list?
Okay.
Okay. So we've got Saffron from World of Warcraft. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He's a blue dragon. He's pretty tough. He comes back as a zombie frostworm after he dies.
Avan Agornin in Tooth and Claw. I'm not familiar with Avan, but in Joe Walton's masterful drawing room melodrama set in a Victorian world ruled by dragons, Avan is a brave attorney.
I have wanted to read this for a really long time. I feel as though it's very Temeraire-like, so I want to get into that. Kalasen at the Farthest Shore, the Earthsea series. He's the dragon who created Earthsea, and like all dragons, the language he speaks is pure magic.
The dragons in D-War, a absurd God. Movie, as Annalie admits, but she argues that the dragon effects were pretty awesome.
Yeah, that was a terrible movie, but the dragons were awesome. Number six, polychromatic dragon from Dungeons & Dragons. They have five heads and they breathe fire, all of them. So that
Do you really need to say any more?
No, yeah. No, five heads.
Vermithrax Perjorative from Dragon Slayer, another movie dragon. This one, Annalie argues, is not too friendly, not too lame. Even though the effects are a little dated, it's a majestic dragon.
Mm-hmm. Number four, The Five Dragons of Lotus, which is a manga anime like series, I guess. I'm not really familiar with it, so I apologize in advance, but they look pretty tough in that picture.
Three would be Killed Mouth from Magic the Gathering. Anybody who's played the card game is familiar with Killed Mouth. Pretty rare, powerful card. When I say you're familiar with Killed Mouth, I'm not saying you have had the card necessarily, but you at least are aware of it, I'm guessing.
It's a very rare card. Very powerful. Number two, Smaug in The Hobbit.
This might be my favorite. This is the red dragon that is hoarding all the stuff, and that's where Bilbo has to go.
And number one, of course, Temeraire.
Oh, gee, I wonder why you like this list.
Temeraire. He is the biggest, smartest dragon in the king's army and possibly all of the world. And people ride on his back and he goes into battles. And he's a civil rights activist for dragons. And it's awesome.
And he's cuddly and fun.
He's very warm. Cuddly. He's got a good heart.
Oh, okay. Well, most dragons are warm.
Yeah. And the bonus dragon, Trogdor.
Yeah.
Trogdor!
That might be my favorite, there above Smaug. He burninates quite well.
Oh, yeah. Big time. Oh, boy. So that was fun. I do enjoy dragons.
Yes. Dragons are good time. So is the calendar. A few books that we have had up on the calendar for a while now are finally out. We're recording this on April 25th, but April 26th, Will Supervillains Be On the Final by Naomi Novik is here.
Yes, and Naomi Novik of Temeraire fame.
This is Naomi Novik's new project.
Yes, but this is not dragon related, but I'm looking forward to reading it anyway because I really enjoy her writing. And then on the 28th, Titus Awakes by Mervyn Peake and Maeve Gilmore. That's going to be out on the 28th, so you still got some time.
And then May 3rd, we've mentioned The Inheritance by Robin Hobb, new short story collection.
Also a regular writer of dragons.
Yeah.
5-3, one of the books I'm waiting for, Dead Reckoning by Charlaine Harris, a new Sookie Stackhouse novel.
This is, if you don't realize, the books that True Blood series on HBO is based on. Mm-hmm. So people very, very excited. Listen to Bike Club Show if you would like more information on Charlaine Harris and all of her doings.
Yeah, book number 11.
May 10th, Fuzzy Nation by John Scalzi. This is a part of a reboot of H. Beam Piper's Hugo-winning Little Fuzzy with Fuzzy Nation. I'm calling it Avatar with Teddy Bears. Essentially, Jack Holloway is a contractor for...
Which Avatar?
Avatar, the James Cameron Avatar.
Okay.
Not Airbender.
Okay.
Jack Holloway is a contractor for Zarakor, a massive interplanetary corporation in the process of harvesting the resources of Zarathustra. Mining rights are only valid if the planet doesn't have sentient natives. And Scalzi's out there on his own and discovers these little, fuzzy, cute, intelligent beings. And he knows the corporation is not going to want to admit they're there.
Sounds just like a Futurama episode.
There you go. That's
Have you
true,
seen
actually.
That Futurama episode?
It's Futurama meets Avatar.
All right. I'm into it. Then on the 10th, The Quantum Thief by Hanu Rajimeni. I hope I'm pronouncing that
close. Rajaniemi, maybe?
Rajaniemi. IO9 says the buzz has been building for months for The Quantum Thief, his debut science fiction, hard science fiction novel, and it's easily one of the most anticipated novels of the year. Published overseas in September of last year, it's just now hitting this side of the Atlantic. The science is hard, but the plot is essentially a crackerjack heist thriller.
All right. And May 17th, I know this is a little way down the road, though, but Embassy Town by China Mieville. Human colonist Avis Benner Cho doesn't speak the unique and nearly impossible to master Reka language, but she's been integrated as a figure of speech. Mm-hmm. Returning to Embassy Town after years away, she finds a new ambassador and upheaval between the humans and the Reka. And Avis isn't entirely confident where her loyalties lie. So you'll get it early in the UK, folks, May 6th, but we have to wait till May 17th here in the US.
A lot of good stuff coming up. All right, well, this podcast, by the way, is brought to you by Audible.com. Yay!
Yay, Audible's back. Thank you, Audible.
The internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many of New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. Now, Tom and I are both listening to new audiobooks right now. I'm apparently on a vampire kick.
Yeah, what is it you're reading?
I'm reading Nice Girls Don't Have Fangs.
Does that make you a nice girl?
I'm not sure yet. It's a very funny book. I'm only about half an hour in. It's by Molly Harper.
And you know, like 25% of our audience just sighed in disappointment.
I know.
Because they're anti-vampire.
I really wanted like a beach read. I was in the mood for something light and fun.
Gotcha.
And, you know, since I have to wait for my Charlaine Harris, I guess I'll take Molly Harper. But they're different, and this is good in its own way as well. So if you're a fan of Charlaine Harris, if you're a fan of True Blood, or even Twilight, check this one out. It's not bad. It's very funny.
I just finished listening to Blindsight on Audible, which I thought was really well read. And now I'm reading Hearts in Atlantis by Stephen King. Mm. I know there's a lot of debate on Goodreads about whether you have to read the side plots to the Dark Tower series. But since I've already gone through Salem's Lot and freaking Insomnia, as well as The Stand, I figured I might as well try Hearts in Atlantis. Really enjoying Hearts in Atlantis a lot more than I did Insomnia. And a lot of business from the Dark Tower in this, so I can see why it supplements it quite well. And then once I'm done reading this, I can actually get back on the actual Dark Tower series again. So I recommend Hearts in Atlantis, even if you're not into Dark Tower. It's a good story. It's actually a collection of stories.
You've bumped up these books so much in my mind now that I feel like I can't even ever start reading them. There's just too much.
Well, I think that's why people on Goodreads were saying you don't need to read the side stuff. Just read the Dark Tower series. You can go get the side stuff later if you want.
I'm just like you. I hate feeling like I'm missing things.
Yeah.
Like I can't just not.
You're a completist.
Yeah, I'm a completionist. For sure. Let's go to
But we should say for a free if you would like to get a free audiobook from Audible, you could get one of these books absolutely free and just try it out. Go to audiblepodcast.com/sword, and when you do, it also registers your approval of our podcast in their eyes.
It does, and we do enjoy that. I think I'm having speech impediment.
Stop it.
Impediment issues due to mixing vitamins and a beer.
There is nothing wrong with mixing vitamins
and beer.
They're vitamins. Beer can have vitamins in them. In fact, beer does have vitamins in it.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Vitamin fortified beer.
I like that thought.
Keep that thought close.
That was a Patrick Nortonism, by the way.
Yes.
I like that thought. So let's go into Barrier Sword, which is our feedback from the audience. And this is a thread that Tom has actually been very vocal in. It's, is Blindsight truly hard sci-fi?
Yeah, Chris started off a really good conversation. He said, hi, new poster here. I'm not even halfway through yet, but I question the claim that this book is hard sci-fi. Sure, it makes attempts to explain elements of the world it creates, but then again, so do comic book origin stories, and those can hardly be called hard sci-fi. Just to be clear, I'm operating under the assumption that so-called hard sci-fi has some footing in actual science. As far as I can tell, the author freely picks and chooses with this actual science and his made-up quasi-science. So there's a lot in this thread if you want to get into it, but essentially Chris was saying he just didn't feel like the science the extrapolation from the science was really true to hard sci-fi. And I disagreed with him. We had a very civil debate about it. And I could totally see where he was coming from. And most of the people who are on that side really have a problem with the fact that there is a creature called a vampire in this book and say, how can you be so hard sci-fi and it be a vampire?
And so what was your point of view? What was your argument?
Well, I say like a lot of people just hear the word vampire and kind of lose their stuff. You know, it's like a political argument. Suddenly they just hate anything with vampires. So you kind of have to set that aside. I think that you can make an argument that a creature much like a vampire, maybe you just have to name it something else to get around that issue, is biologically possible. And what he's talking about is genetic engineering. And so I don't feel like that totally compromises the sci-fi aspect of it. But I think Chris is taking a harder line than me and saying, you know what, it's got to be 100% or nothing for me. And that's just too far over the line. I think that that Watts uses a lot of grid physics. The flight of the ship is very hard sci-fi to me. The way it approaches the anomaly, the way it approaches the planet, I think that's all very well written and grounded in good science. And this is where I also was interested in what Chris thought. I thought the psychology and sociology was very well grounded in a lot of respected sociology and psychology. So, you know, for me, I felt like he really was hard sci-fi in his astrophysics and even in his cultural stuff, fairly hard sci-fi. But I think a lot of people, once it goes away from spaceships and physics and starts to talk about sociology and psychology, those sciences aren't hard enough right now for them to be comfortable calling that hard sci-fi.
I don't know. I think it might be the vampire bit that threw him off, as Sauden says in the threads as well. I'm inclined to agree more with Chris on this one, I think. I think there are so many books out there that are hard sci-fi that are truly, you know, hard sci-fi, like real science. And I think this deviates from that line a little more than is necessary. This can just be sci-fi. There's no reason for not to just be sci-fi that has a basis in some science. But to call it hard sci-fi, I don't know if that's accurate.
Well, Chris says in one posting during this thread that he looked up the term hard sci-fi and tried to find a consensus definition. There really isn't one consensus definition. And that's part of the fun of this thread is figuring out like, well, what is hard sci-fi to different people? Because there's not one right answer to this. But he does say that Hal Clements' Whirligig World outlines strategies for writing hard sci-fi. In the article, he outlines what he calls the game of hard sci-fi. It is for the reader finding as many possible of the author's statements or implications that conflict with the facts of science as currently understood. The author is trying to rule to make as few of those slips as possible. He goes on to state that the use of gobbledygook, like inventions of jargon, should be rejected. He claims that speculation in areas where scientific conclusions have not been drawn should also be avoided. He says hard sci-fi writers should limit themselves to cautious predictions of near future technology. And he specifically discusses things such as the afterlife and telepathy, claiming that they are unsuitable for truly hard sci-fi. So how do you feel that applies to Blind Sight so far?
I don't think it applies. Really. I mean, there's a lot of talk of the, well, I'm not far enough in. I can't really make that call yet. I'm only 30% in.
I don't think there's gobbledygook. There's some invention of jargon, but it's all regarding things that are possible or nearly possible, in my opinion. You know,
gobbledygook. I can see with the technology so far, from what I've seen, it seems to be like near future technology for the most part.
Yeah,
the gobbledygook isn't that out of you know, expectations.
I think the idea of gobbledygook is when you don't have an understanding of how the ship's propulsion system works and you just call it warp drive and you don't explain what that means. Mm-hmm. But if you call it warp drive and you're saying, well, it's warping time and space and here's how it works, you've invented jargon, but you've got something behind it. I don't feel like Watts is just coming up with stuff. He actually goes into deep explanations in his appendix of what he means behind that.
Well, then I'm going to have to really figure out what the whole vampire situation is about. You know, really, once I get into the book more and understand that better, and then maybe I can make a better call, because I don't know what that's all about yet.
And I think that's where maybe the second of Clement's positions might be a conflict with calling Watts hard sci-fi. Speculation in areas where scientific conclusions have not been drawn. Mm-hmm. Certainly most of the stuff that Watts talks about is where scientific conclusions have been drawn as far as physics goes, but with psychology and sociology, it's all wide open. We don't know if the singularity is near or not. You know, we don't know if we can actually translate a human brain's impulses into virtual reality. It's not a big leap. We're very close to doing all this stuff, but it is more of an extrapolation than saying, well, we know how it would work. We just haven't got there yet, which you can say with spaceship drives and the way space works versus the human mind. So it's all a matter of how much you want to allow, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think we'll have to revisit this discussion once I'm truly done the book and kind of see where how I feel about it at that point.
Yeah. And as a lot of people said, in the end, it's really a matter of, does it appeal to you? If you're somebody who likes hard sci-fi, whether this counts or not is going to be whether you like it or not, I think.
Yeah, I am liking it so far. There was another thread that kind of went into the discussion of, is this a horror book?
Mm.
And I'm very interested to see where that goes too, because
right.
I'm starting to get into that area at this point.
And there's certainly an argument to be made, in my opinion, that this is a horror book. But I don't think that stops it from being a sci-fi book. You can have a sci-fi book
definitely.
Being a horror book.
Absolutely.
I mean, that happens in movies all the time.
Mm-hmm. I'm liking it. I'm intrigued by the book. Some of it I'm finding hard to follow. I guess we're kind of getting into the book check-in at this point. We interrupt this barrier sword for a brief
second. Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm finished, so I'm just going to hold back a little. You tell me where you're at and what you're thinking.
Okay. I am enjoying it, which I expected to enjoy it when I first picked it up. And then I had a little bit of I don't know if I love this character. I don't know if I'm really understanding what's going on. There were a lot of passages I had to go back and reread a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And just so I made sure that I understood what they were talking about. But now I'm feeling better about it, and I'm getting into the more interesting parts of the interactions with the creatures they encounter. So that's becoming a lot more of a vibrant read for me now.
I think that's why it's hard sci-fi. If you can't understand it, it's hard sci-fi. No, I kid. But I know what you mean. It did take me a little while to really get comfortable with the story. When you have this many characters and you're doing this many flash forwards, flashbacks, it always takes me a little while to get comfortable. But once I got comfortable, it really started to click for me. And I think one of the reasons I got so into the discussing of whether it's hard sci-fi or not is that I thought the science of the psychology and sociology sounds entirely plausible. This is all drawn from current research, and it's all drawn from current theories of the way we think the brain works. And a lot of psychological phenomena and a lot of like brain science phenomena, like the title of the book, Blindsight, for instance, that's a real thing. And a lot of this stuff about how we can sever the brains so that we continue to operate but have no consciousness of how we're operating and all of that. That's all real psychological science. And so using that as a philosophical ground to jump off and start talking about, well, what are we experiencing? And what is this entity that we're visiting experiencing? I think that's good stuff.
I definitely got a chill down my spine in that scene. The last thing that I guess this isn't, is it spoilery? I don't know.
Well, for anybody
when
who's
it calls out
about spoilers,
Susan by name.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, snap.
Yeah, but again, that's all very plausible if it's just monitoring communications, indexing. And that's why we talked about the Chinese room mm-hmm. in the kickoff, because a Chinese room scenario where you have a computer that can interpret language and respond but isn't conscious of what it's doing can do all of those things.
And I was happy they reiterated the Chinese room and explained what that was in case you forgot or in case you didn't listen to the podcast and didn't hear us talk about that.
Did you not listen to the podcast?
I'm sorry. I was so busy. I didn't get a chance to listen to that episode.
Yeah. know. You were on the sword and laser. You were on the podcast. What?
Oh, that one. That one. Yeah, I did hear that one. But moving on to a different topic, because we'll come back to Blindsight next week, of course. I wanted to get your opinion, because I do not watch the series. What do you think of the new Doctor Who?
Yes. This will be the 50th podcast where I've discussed this.
All right, briefly.
Honestly, I don't mind. I'm a huge fan of Doctor Who, especially the reboot series. It made me a bigger Doctor Who fan than I had ever been before. And the new Doctor, I'm totally on board with. I'm still, David Tennant is my favorite, but Matt Smith is doing a cracking good job. However, and it's hard to talk about this without being spoilery, am skeptical of the direction they've gone with this first episode of the new season. I like a lot of what they're doing. I think Stephen Moffat is brilliant at creating monsters, and I love the concept of the monster in this first episode. I love a lot of some subtle nods to previous Doctor Who episodes from the past five seasons. But they start off with kind of a big shocker. That's one of those tropes where you're like, really? This is kind of manipulative. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Not sure if I'm okay with this. We got to see how you resolve it first.
Mm-hmm. Are the monsters scary?
Yeah. Scary. Stephen Moffat monsters are scary in a very mental way. They're not scary in a gory way. I don't know if you know about the Weeping Angels in previous series.
No.
They are monsters.
As someone who considers herself a geek, I know less about Doctor Who than anyone I know.
Well,
and that is weird considering I'm friends with you. And
you've got to watch Blink. I don't care if you watch any other episodes of Doctor Who. Go watch Blink. It's just a good television episode. And the premise is that the monsters are statues of angels. But the reason they're statues is they have a quantum protection where they can't move if you're looking at them. They're like, you know, like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, mm-hmm. you know, it's sort of a play on that. Talk about not being hard sci-fi. It's playing very fast and loose with that. But it's really scary because if you're not looking at them, they can move and they can kill you.
Why do they want to kill you?
Well, because they want to suck away your life.
Oh.
And make it as if you were never born so they can get the time energy out of you.
Oh,
or something
and then,
like
and
that.
Then they can be like, they can move when people are looking at them?
No. Well, there's another episode in the Matt Smith series where some of them do move, but they're not really the same thing. They're imitating it. But the Weeping Angels themselves, they can't move if you're looking at them. But man, if you're not looking at them, they can move and they can move fast.
Hmm. Interesting. That is creepy.
Don't blink. Blink and you're dead.
Oh, that's where it comes from. I got it. All right, well, that's all I think we've got for today. We've got a few more emails that I wanted to catch up on. This one comes from Robert. He says, I'm glad that I listened to your podcast. Thank you, Robert.
Thanks, Robert.
I also expected more out of the first episode, not of our show, of Game of Thrones.
He's referring to his subject line. That happens sometimes.
But welcome the confusion / unanswered questions. I look forward and hope future episodes will fill in those blanks to keep me interested with new confusion / unanswered questions. I also agree about the 15 minutes before the premiere. What was that supposed to be anyway? Lol.
Yeah.
I was about to get the books or ebooks to read, seriously thinking about it anyway. After listening to your podcast and hearing about the differences, I think that would add unwanted confusion. I'm not an SNL frequent listener, hey, or fantasy book reader. I wanted to hear about Game of Thrones. I may decide to hold off on the show and decide to read the book anyway. Then watch the series. Not sure yet. Probably normal having differences between the book and series, but it's new to me. At least I know not to read while watching. Thanks for the education, Robert.
That's an interesting approach to this. I think you could read and watch, but I think he's right. I think it would be confusing. And it's probably best to hold off. I don't know that it's a bad thing to watch the TV series and then read the book later. But I personally, having read the book first, I think that's the best way to go.
I'm very happy to have read the books first. I just feel excited seeing the things come to life on the screen, and that's one of the most rewarding parts about watching this show for me. But also, I like knowing the little things going on inside their minds or their motivations behind things before other people do. It's almost like having the show spoiled for you, but at the same time, it's really fun to see come to life.
And that is the thing, where, you know, I've talked about this before too, is with Game of Thrones, everything you need to know to understand the episode is in the episode, mm-hmm. but you have to pay really close attention unless you already know it because you've read the books.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, well, Robert, I hope you listen to more episodes of The Sword and Laser. We talk about Game of Thrones a lot, so if you're watching the show, you'll get the fill in. Not too much that we don't like to spoil.
John writes in, says, "Hey, V&T, hate to sound like a PR flack. I'm not, just a reader. But I stumbled upon a real gem of a story at the Kindle store called Out of the Dark by first-time author Lee Doty and was impressed enough to write to you guys about it. I took away hints of Neil Gaiman and Neil Stephenson." Sounds like he's describing wine. "I get hints of Neil Gaiman and Stephenson, a big helping of Jim Butcher, a pinch of Tim Powers, and some essence of Elmore Leonard. But this rookie manages to retain his own strong voice and with humor, no less. Mr. Doty displays the writing chops of a veteran, pacing, character development, dialogue, all first class, no lasers, but swords, martial arts, and unconventional firearms are all employed to great effect without overwhelming the storyline. According to his Kindle page, he's a certified geek, a programmer who wrote this novel during the daily train commute to and from his day job and self-published on Kindle. Judging by the Kindle discussion board, he's still enthusiastic enough to answer all his readers' emails personally. Read the book for sure, but think about getting him on the podcast as well."
That does sound very interesting.
All right. Out of the Dark, Lee Doty. I'm going to keep my eye on it. That is a ringing endorsement, John.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's all we have for today. So, guys, keep reading Blindsight if you haven't finished it already, like Tom. You're so fast with reading sometimes, Tom, if you finish the book.
Yeah, this was audible, you know. I know we're not supposed to do the commercial twice, but just having an audiobook means that I can read in a lot of situations that I wouldn't otherwise.
Gotcha. All right, everyone. Well, we will see you next time. If you want to get in touch with us, theswordandlaser@gmail.com is the email address to use. Theswordandlaser.com is the website, as always. And all our discussions go down on goodreads.com. Check us out there.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time. Oh, and don't forget our iPhone app. If you like it, leave a nice review for Nicole.
Thanks.
See you later.